go away. Not a thing, Martina whispers back, touching the pad of her thumb and index finger together and running them across her lips like a zipper. It's a little weird keeping it hidden, but there's no point in upsetting them yet, not until we find out more. Aster greets us at the door wearing a red and teal sarong. A little white dog runs circles around her feet. This is Julia Child, she says. Zoe named her. I squat down to offer Julia Child my hand to sniff, but she completes her laps around Aster and runs off into the back of the house without even acknowledging my presence. She's 9 and still a total energy ball, Aster says. Don't take it personally. We make our way through the house and into the kitchen, and to my disappointment, or relief, nothing looks particularly familiar. It's a nice house with nice stuff, but there are no chilly tendrils of memory reaching out to grab me like the other night. The possibility that I was just confusing Heron Mills and my recent deep dive into Zoe's life with some memories of childhood vacations dances at the back of my mind. In the kitchen, Aster and Martina flutter around collecting cups, straws, and a pitcher of something that looks like lemonade. I'm instructed to grab a tote bag filled with snacks, and then we head through a large red stone archway connecting the kitchen to an airy breakfast nook, which then leads out to the pool. When we step through the sliding glass doors, I stop doubting myself. I may not have Kaylee's steel trap memory, but the pool is unmistakable. I press my lips between my teeth and try to keep the mix of shock and validation off my face. Maybe there was a similar glassed-in pool at the hotel in Stone Harbor. But this is the pool that's been tugging at the edges of my memory, telling me to pay attention. I'm so focused on keeping my expression neutral that I don't realize I've stopped walking. My feet are glued to the terracotta tiles, my eyes roving all around, taking in the lush vines, the pink and orange and yellow blooms, the delicate waterfall, all the details I knew I'd find. The dog scampers in through the sliding glass doors and brushes past my legs in a blur of white, yapping at something only she can see in the air in front of her. What's out there, Belle? I squat down and extend my hand toward her again. Aster turns slowly to face me. What did you call her? Choosing that moment to acknowledge my existence, the dog nuzzles her little pink and white snout into my hand. I look up. Julia Child, right? Right, she says, face tilted slightly to the side. I thought... Aster trails off, and Martina clears her throat, saving us from the awkwardness. Pretty amazing, right? She gestures with her chin around the space. It's gorgeous, I say, straightening up. I thought the Bellamy's pool was impressive, but this is something else. My dad's in landscaping, Aster says. She's slipped out of her sarong and stands at a glass-topped table in a black tankini, filling 3 plastic pineapple-shaped cups from the lemonade pitcher. I force my legs to work again, to carry me over to where she's standing so I can unload the snacks onto the table. Martina slips her dress over her head, revealing a blue and white polka dot one piece with a little skirt that's either actually vintage or styled to look that way. He worked with another architect who specializes in glass to design the pool when we moved in, Aster continues. I'm sure he'll find his way down here at some point tonight. He'll talk your ear off about it if you let him. Lemon spritz? She holds a pineapple cup out toward me, and I accept. It's a mocktail, Martina clarifies before I can place the pink and white paper straw between my lips. So don't get too excited. I don't really drink, I say. Or I'm trying not to, so this is perfect. We walk over to the lounge chairs at the edge of the pool and settle in. This pool is like something out of a magazine, I say, fishing. Aster laughs. Well, between landscape architect dad and magazine editor mom, you could say they're a little obsessed with aesthetics. Did her magazine ever run a profile? I ask. I don't think so, Aster says. They probably should. Mrs. Spanos is something else, Martina adds. She had kind of major shoulder surgery last fall, and she took like one day off work. Not even that, Aster says. She was working from her hospital bed. Your parents sound like the Bellamys. Aside from the fourth, I haven't seen them take a day off all summer. Martina shrugs. That's how it is out here. When people hear Hamptons, they think bougie vacation spot. But everyone's a workaholic. I slip out of my damp cutoffs and t-shirt and hang them on the back of the chair. Not that they have much hope of drying out with the humidity in here. As the sun fades out and rain streams in silver rivulets down the outsides of the glass walls, it hits that for the first time this summer, I don't have to worry about sunscreen. Martina and Aster start chatting about some kids in their class, and I take a sip of my mocktail. The bite of the lemonade and fizz of the seltzer taste familiar too, somehow, like a memory on my tongue. Before I know it, I've drained the whole cup. They're good, right? Aster asks, drawing me into their conversation. The lemon spritz is a George Spanos specialty. Did I hear my name? We all turn our heads to look back to the sliding glass doors, where a bearded, thick-waisted man in his late 40s now stands. He's wearing plaid golf shorts and a lime green polo shirt. Julia Child lets out a series of excited yaps and scrambles from beneath Aster's lounger. While he leans down to scoop her up, I hurry to twist my hair behind my head and loop it into a messy bun with the elastic on my wrist. There's no need for sunglasses, but I slip on the pair from my bag anyway. This is Zoe's dad. The last thing he needs is to find a ghost in his backyard. Hey, Dad. Aster pushes up from her lounge chair and walks back to the snack table. This is Martina's friend, Anna, she says, motioning toward me with her chin and filling a bowl with rosemary and Parmesan popcorn. Mr. Spanos squints at me. Despite my efforts to minimize the Zoe factor, I know the resemblance is still there, that he's registering it now. I start to ramble, my usual spiel about nannying for Paisley and how much I'm enjoying Heron Mills and where I'm going to college in the fall. His face relaxes a little. I'm sure my verbal deluge has done wonders to set me apart from his star student daughter. When he retreats into the living room to watch a movie with his wife, I keep my sunglasses on. A few minutes later, we're treated to a check-in from Mrs. Spanos, who I definitely recognize from somewhere. I've probably seen her around town. The thought that her hair looks different pops into my head. Not that I have any idea what it looked like before. Then at 9, Mr. Spanos peeks in again. They're extra hovery tonight, Martina observes. Not that they're not always a bit, overprotective, Aster laughs. Always were on the helicopter side, but it's gotten a lot worse since January. Her voice drops. It's me, I blurt out. I know it's weird how we look alike. I tell them about Paisley and how Amelia let her pick her summer nanny. Martina snorts. That's hilarious. And totally fitting, Aster adds. Paisley adored Zoe. Adores. We're all quiet for a moment, letting Aster's slip of the tongue linger on the air. It's morbid to think about, but Aster's put a voice to the question no one seems to want to ask. After nearly 7 months, could Zoe really, possibly still be alive? I miss her every minute, Aster says after a beat. I thought it would fade eventually, but I don't think it ever will. Martina reaches out from her lounger and slips her hand into her friend's. Feeling like a third wheel, I get up to refill my lemon spritz. In a minute, Aster clears her throat. "I should have warned them about the doppelganger effect," she says. "It's my bad." I can feel her eyes lingering on the back of my head. "It's less pronounced with her hair up," Martina observes. "Do you think I should cut it?" "Because of Zoe?" Aster asks. "Definitely not. That's like letting the weirdness win." "I think it looks good long," Martina agrees. "Me too," I sigh. "I'm just ready for all the weirdness to go away." While Martina calls her mom to request a pickup at a few minutes before the appointed time, I slip back into my still damp shorts and top, and Aster points me toward the hall bathroom so I can pee before we go. Halfway there, I sense a pair of eyes on me.
"Anna."
I spin around. Out of the shadows of what must be their living room, Mr. Spano steps into the brightness of the hall. He's taller than I realized, and his beard needs a trim. Something feral and hungry dances in his eyes, which fix on me like steel clamps for a moment that stretches on for days. I'm an animal, snared.
"I just wanted to say what a pleasure it was to meet you," he says finally,
but his friendly words hold a challenge, something quivering beneath the surface. I'm frozen in my tracks, but my whole body is shaking. He doesn't seem to notice. His gaze is still trained squarely on my face.
"What did you say your last name was?"
"I didn't," I say quickly, my voice a thin rasp. "It's Ciccone." His shoulders drop then, like those of a marionette whose strings have been clipped, and he leans heavily to the side, full weight pressed against a closed closet door.
"You should leave."
His voice is soft, but there's no kindness in the words. His grief is right there, shimmering. "I'm sorry." I'm not even sure what I'm apologizing for, a father's suffering, or my resemblance to his missing daughter. "We're waiting for Martina's mom. I was just..." I gesture weakly toward the bathroom, arm trembling.
"Of course,"
he says, recovering himself. I feel his eyes on me the whole way down the hall. Inside the bathroom, I slump on the edge of the tub and try to stop shaking. His daughter is gone, and here I am, standing in his house, breathing Zoe's air. So thoughtless. I wrap my arms tight around my waist. There was something more than grief in the way he looked at me. Blame, or pure, unfiltered rage. I have the itchy feeling that if I had just looked closer, I might have seen what's bottled up inside his chest. I press my fists into my eyes, trying to force my brain into submission. It refuses. Then I lean over and hang my head between my knees, hair spilling out of its topknot and dusting the floor in a thick black curtain. I can't stop seeing the hard outline of his face. Deep breath in, deep breath out. Maybe I'm reading him wrong. Maybe it was only grief, after all, bubbling to the surface in all its ugly trappings. Grief like a gaping wound for a daughter who is gone and likely not coming home again. I feel immediately guilty for making something sinister out of this man's pain. I let myself wonder what it would be like to have parents who are so present. Helicopter parents, Aster called them. My mind wanders briefly to the second episode of Martina's podcast, to her conversation with Aster's friend from swim team, how she'd been disgusted with people on Reddit for criticizing the Spanos' parenting skills, accusing them of a lack of vigilance. Now that I've met them, it's clear they're the opposite of inattentive. I can't even get a geographical region for my dad, let alone an email or phone number. And much as Mom complained about me going away this summer,
It's not like we'd actually see much of each other if I was home. Not with her two jobs and irregular schedule. I can't even imagine having parents hanging out at home, supervising on a Friday night. It's kind of nice how much they care. That's the important thing. I make myself get up and actually pee and get ready to leave. By the time Martina's mom texts that she's out front, I'm calm again, convinced Mr. Spanos wasn't actually as scary as he seemed. The creeped-out feeling has been replaced by a new kind of nostalgia, something distinct from the flashes of memory I've been experiencing all summer. This is more like a longing for a childhood different from my own. Zoe's childhood, maybe, or Martina's. A childhood with money and two parents who won't let you borrow the car because they're worried about you, who won't let you out of their sight because they love you that much. But Zoe vanished anyway, I remind myself, and my stomach coils into a tight knot.
Chapter 24. Now, September. Heron Mills, New York. Martina refreshes her screen every 2 minutes, but no new updates have posted since early afternoon. This is all she's going to get. Tiana Percy coming forward was a hot story for an hour this morning, but it's already faded into the background. Martina should be solving the SAT practice problems she promised Dad she'd do tonight, or struggling through the Spanish homework that might come a bit easier if Mommy had ever spoken Spanish with her growing up. Instead, Martina presses play on the video clip one more time. The words, "breaking news," fill the screen in silver block letters. New information has emerged today in the ongoing Zoe Spanos homicide investigation, a too perky newscaster says from behind the desk. Yale University senior Tiana Percy has come forward as an alibi witness for Caden Talbot, boyfriend of slain Heron Mills teen Zoe Spanos. Miss Spanos disappeared from Heron Mills on her way to a house party last New Year's Eve, and her body was recovered from nearby Parrish Lake in August. Mr. Talbot was previously identified as a person of interest in the investigation and has been cooperating with police. Photos of Zoe, Caden, and Tiana fill the screen as the newscaster continues. Ms. Percy spoke voluntarily with the Heron Mills PD this morning after a high school friend posted a series of photos online, placing her with Caden Talbot at a New Year's Eve party in Westchester during the window police have identified for Zoe's death. Ms. Percy was unwilling to comment on the nature of her relationship with classmate Caden Talbot, but says she was aware of Mr. Talbot's relationship with Ms. Spanos. Martina slumps back in her desk chair. She has to admit, she never liked Caden for Zoe's killer, to borrow a term from police speak. But until now, those hours after 10:30 p.m. had remained unaccounted for. With Tiana proving Caden's whereabouts, at her side in her Westchester hometown, Caden's innocence has been verified. Tiana was able to pull up tons of photos from the party, all of which she'd been saving on her phone. They hadn't been shared anywhere online, at Caden's request. But Tiana's photos can be matched to others from that same party, posted online by Tiana's friends, placing Caden in Rye, New York, between the hours of 11:45 p.m. and 3 a.m. It's a two-hour drive from Rye to Heron Mills under the best of circumstances. Caden definitely wasn't with Zoe at the White Sand Marina when the last GPS activity registered on her phone. He couldn't have had anything to do with the purchase of the Greyhound ticket, at least not in person. He couldn't have made it out to Heron Mills and back to the Upper West Side by 6:30 when he was seen by Doreen Wynn Carey on her living room couch. Neither Caden Talbot nor Tiana Percy were responsible for Zoe's death. Martina pulls up Aster's number, fires off a text. "Hi, I'm around if you want to talk. Miss you." Martina doesn't expect a reply. "I hear you got Caden to talk." Anna sounds excited today, energized. Martina hates to be the one to burst her bubble. "Yes and no," she says, exhaustion evident in her voice. It's Friday, the day after Tiana came forward, the end of a long week. Martina's in Miss Foxrigg's chemistry lab again, staring out the window into sheets of driving rain. The storm's going to mess up the tape, but it doesn't matter. She's not planning to air this interview. This is just a chance for them to talk. Episode 6 went live on Tuesday, to 30,000 downloads and counting. She'd been right. People wanted to hear Caden speak. Even if what she ultimately aired was all about Anna and a 2-month-old unsolved stable fire. It had been too much to hope Caden would actually open up about his relationship with Zoe, or Tiana. Yes and no? Anna repeats Martina's words back to her. What does that mean? I got my interview, Martina says. But he wouldn't go on the record about the night of Zoe's disappearance. Not that I expected he would. Anna sighs. Thanks for getting me that address, by the way. No problem. Any response? Not yet. I'm not giving up, though. I hope you hear back, Martina says. Keep me posted? Anna steers the conversation back to Caden. Did you ask him about the empties in the stable? Did he say anything privately? Her voice is so eager. Martina gets it. Caden may have a solid alibi now, but it doesn't change the fact that he knows something. And now that he's been cleared in the investigation, it's unlikely the police will talk to him again. Martina scrubs her hand across her eyes. She is slowly beginning to fit the pieces together. Understand how this all led to the charges against Anna. When Zoe's body was found in August, Caden was brought back in to speak with the Heron Mills PD. They re-interviewed everyone they'd previously talked to regarding Zoe's case. He felt guilty or scared. Something compelled him to tell the police about the bottles he'd found. She can visualize how the conversation went down. Tell us every detail about the afternoon of January 1st, even if it didn't seem important at the time. That's what police always say. So Caden told them about the empties, how he figured some local kids had broken onto the property while he and his mom were away, how he tossed them, how he'd never tied them to Zoe because she didn't drink. When the police interviewed Anna, she said she was drinking with Zoe at Windermere that night. She probably mentioned Caden's Glenlivet, and they got her to say they were also drinking beer. The police made sure Anna's story fit Caden's. Match point. I did ask, Martina says. He told me the same thing he told police, as far as I can tell. Anna groans, the sound reverberating through the phone line. I don't believe him, she says. Caden knows who was drinking in the stable that night. He has to. How many people knew he kept whiskey hidden there? They made me think it was me, but it wasn't. I'm sure of that now. Martina wishes she could be that certain. She wants to believe Anna unequivocally. But Zoe's killer wasn't Tiana. It wasn't Caden. The suspect pool is getting smaller and smaller, and no one's coming forward to provide an alibi witness for Anna Ciccone.
Chapter 25. Then, July, Heron Mills, New York. The weekend rolls into the new week with nonstop rain, a new baking project with Paisley, peppermint brownies this time, a Disney movie marathon, and finally sunshine and back to the beach on Tuesday. Martina still hasn't heard from Tiana Percy, and at this point, we're both starting to give up hope. Maybe she figured out who Martina was. Maybe I should have been the one to email her. Maybe she doesn't check her university account over the summer. With the Zoe Caden Tiana triangle still a mystery, and all my little memory fragments of Heron Mills and Zoe still refusing to coalesce into a real, tangible piece of my very recent past that I can grasp onto, July in Heron Mills barrels on.
On Wednesday, Emilia gives me permission to take Paisley into the city on a day trip, something Paisley has been asking for nearly since I arrived. Second to the Zoe factor, clearly the New York City appeal was my other big draw. We take the train back Wednesday evening, exhausted and stuffed with pierogi from Veselka and way too much froyo from 16 Handles, green tea vanilla for me, and something called cake batter with about 10 toppings for Paisley. The instant we clamber into Amelia's car at Bridgehampton, she says she wants a moment of my time when we get home, which can't be good. I spend the 10-minute ride sweating, racking my brain for ways I might have messed up with Paisley, then wondering if, after all this time, the Bellamys checked my references and didn't like what they found. Fortunately, Paisley fills the air in the car with a detailed rendition of the day's events. Late morning picnic in Central Park with bagels and lox from Zabar's, followed by the Let's Dance and Art, Artists, and You exhibits at the Children's Museum of Manhattan, then downtown for a Meet the Residents tour at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, which I'd worried might appeal more to me than Paisley, but was the runaway hit of the day, second only to dessert. When we step through the front door at Clavelli Cottage, the first thing I see is flowers. Lots and lots of flowers. 4 huge bouquets on the white marble table in the entry hall, bursting with purple irises, red poppies, bright yellow sunflowers, and a whole host of blooms I don't recognize by name. It looks like someone got married in here today, and the happy couple left all the floral arrangements behind. "Wow," Paisley says. "These are beautiful, Amelia. Are you hosting another event?" "Actually, Anna," she replies, voice tight, "these are for you." Amelia sends Paisley upstairs to get ready for bed, to a chorus of protests. I promise to run up to say goodnight once I'm done talking to Amelia, a rarity since it's far past the regular Clavelli Cottage dinner time and Paisley's bedtime. She vanishes up the stairs. "A young man named Max Adler stopped by while you were out today," Amelia says. "You know you're perfectly welcome to go out or have guests over outside work hours, but he arrived with 2 other friends who he seemed to have recruited to carry floral arrangements right in the middle of a client call. It was disruptive." "I'm so sorry," I say, heat flooding my cheeks. "I had no idea he was coming over. I barely know the guy, and I haven't heard from him in weeks. I don't know how he even found me here." Amelia's face softens. "Men will go to great lengths in their pursuit of a beautiful woman." She gives me a small smile. "I'm really sorry," I repeat. "Honestly, after the way we left things, I never thought I'd hear from him again. I'll let him know he can't show up here unannounced like that." "I overreacted," Amelia says, eyes drifting up the stairs after Paisley. She lowers her voice. "I'm the one who should be apologizing. Things have been difficult with Tom this summer." The flowers touched a nerve. I swallow, mind retracing Tom's sometimes furtive behavior over the past few weeks. I've been so focused on other things, I haven't given Tom a lot of thought. But looking at Amelia's pained face, it hits me that maybe something is going on between him and Joan Spanos. Amelia has acted a little strange every time the topic of Zoe's mom has come up. Maybe I should have told her about seeing Tom's car when he said he was at the office late that first week, and about the person who called looking for him the other night. "Is something going on with Mrs. Spanos?" I ask, heat crawling up my neck. "With Tom and Joan?" Amelia bursts out laughing. I slip my foot out of my sandal and scratch my big toe against my ankle. I'm not sure what's so funny. "No, honey," Amelia says, recovering herself. When I was just a couple years older than you, this was years before I met Tom, I had my first graphic design internship at Jones Magazine. She and I were involved for a bit. I guess you could say Joan was my first love. She was separated from her husband at the time, but they got back together, and Joan and I fell out of touch. Oh! My mind flashes to the photo I found in the back of Amelia's desk when I was rooting around for flash drives. Amelia was young. She had her arm wrapped around an older woman with dark, waist-length hair. Joan Spanos. That's why she looked so familiar the other night. Anyway, that's ancient history, Amelia says after a minute. Tom's not. It's not an affair. At first, I thought he was seeing someone else. We fought about it over the 4th. But it's not that. Work has been hard. The company's struggling. The partners reduced his client load by half at the start of the summer. He was too embarrassed to tell me. She sighs and runs a hand along the marble tabletop. I didn't realize, I say after a minute. So that's why Tom's been avoiding the office. You thought the flowers were from him? She straightens back up. It was silly of me to get upset. As I'm sure you're already figuring out, relationships are rarely easy. Can I ask you something? I say after a minute. Did you recognize that guy Max today? Amelia frowns. I don't think so. Not that I can recall, anyway. Why? We met him at the aquarium. He works there. Paisley seemed to know him from somewhere, so I was just curious. Amelia shakes her head back and forth, brown bob swishing. He didn't seem familiar, but Paisley has sharp eyes. She smiles. Now, do you want help carrying these to the pool house? I stare at the lavish bouquets, but all I can see is Max's face twisted into an ugly scowl when I shoved him off me on Montauk. They look so beautiful in the entryway, I say. Would you mind if we left them here? Of course not. Amelia plucks a small white card from the center bouquet. But you should have this. I take a peek at the card, which reads simply, Anna, I'm so sorry. Max. Then I shove it in my pocket and excuse myself to go say a quick goodnight to Paisley so Amelia can get on with the bedtime routine. On my way up the stairs, I text Max. That was quite a gesture, but you can't just show up at my employer's house. Please don't do that again. His reply comes right away. Sorry about that. I only wanted to apologize. One bouquet for each week I should have called you. I hope you'll forgive me, Anna. Typical. He doesn't call for nearly 4 weeks, then makes some expensive, cliched gesture. Even if I'd been into him in the first place, I'd never go for that. 4 weeks is about 3.5 weeks too long. Besides, he's an ass. Before I can write back, he texts again. Not just for not calling, but also for how I acted on the 4th. It was unacceptable, and I'm sorry. Consider your apology accepted, but I don't think we're a good fit. Night, Max. I press send to get him off my back, then switch my phone to silent. I make my way to Paisley's bedroom, a pretty peach room at the end of the second floor hallway, on the side of Clovelly Cottage facing Windermere. We've played in here a few times, but I haven't spent a lot of time on the second floor. It's a few minutes before 9, and Paisley is changed into a nightgown. On a regular night, Amelia would already have her tucked into bed. I find her seated on a little stool at the room's south-facing window, peering at the night sky through a telescope. I forgot you were into astronomy. She turns and shrugs. We only hang out during the day. But now you can take a turn. I survey the several astronomy guides for kids spread open on a round play table near the window.
Tacked to a corkboard on the wall behind it is a big checklist of constellations, planets, moon stages, and their corresponding observation dates. "It's really clear tonight," she says. "You can see Virgo, she's the maiden, and Leo the lion." Paisley stands up to let me take a look. After a quick, fruitless search for the stars she's describing, I tilt the telescope gently down toward Windermere. At first, I can't tell what I'm seeing. The estate itself is too far toward the road to get a good look from this vantage point. But as I adjust the lens, my view focuses in on the riding pen and a clear shot of the charred patch of earth where the stable used to be. I return the telescope to its skyward-facing position. "Do you ever look next door?" I ask Paisley. "At Windermere?" She scrunches her nose at me. "That would be snooping." I shrug. "I'd be curious, that's all." "I have to brush my teeth," she says, hurrying suddenly into the hall and toward the bathroom. Clearly, this conversation is a non-starter. I'm left alone in her bedroom. Maybe Paisley is a better person than I am, but if I were an 8-year-old with the clear view of the neighbor's backyard, I'd never be able to tear my eyes away. Back in the pool house, I lie on top of the sheets and stare at the ceiling. I click my phone on out of habit, not even sure what I want. Information, validation, something real. In Messenger, I avoid my one-sided exchange with Star and scroll instead through old conversations with Kaylee, Mike, some girls from school I haven't thought about since graduation. There's no one I want to talk to. Bored, I click over to requests to see if anyone new has found me lately. My heart freezes in my chest. Buried beneath a string of highs and sups and hey beautifuls from guys I don't know are two requests dated December 10th and December 28th. The messages are from Zoe Spanos.
Part 4. A Body. You're a story, but that doesn't make you any less true. Melissa Albert, The Hazelwood. Chapter 26. Now, September. Heron Mills, New York. It's called a pretrial motion to dismiss. They filed it yesterday on the grounds of police misconduct. I shouldn't have been interrogated for hours without a recording, or before my mother arrived. And of course, my confession was inconsistent with the autopsy results, which should help my case. Anna's voice is alive today. There's none of the dull flatness Martina has become used to. So, what happens now? It's almost 5 on Saturday afternoon. Martina is positioned in her bedroom closet again, talking to Anna when she should be doing about 5 other things. She's supposed to take the SATs next weekend, but Mommy and Dad don't know she's already rescheduled for the November exam date. This is more important than some test she's going to bomb anyway. We hope the judge agrees to dismiss the case, but a lot can still happen. Such as? Well, the prosecution will probably file a response contesting our motion. My lawyer said it's almost guaranteed that will happen, so I'm ready for it. Then the judge sets a date for both sides to appear in court and argue our positions. And then she decides whether or not to grant the motion? Right. If she denies it, we're back to where we started. Either I agree to a plea or we go to trial. But if she grants it, the charges against me will be dismissed. I get to go home. Martina's not sure, but she thinks the strain she hears in Anna's voice might be tears. How long will you have to wait? She asks softly. I'm not sure. I think the prosecution has to respond pretty fast, but then it depends on the judge's schedule and what date gets set. Martina exhales slowly through her teeth. Zoe's family is going to be livid. She can already envision the holes Aster's eyes will bore into her skull at school on Monday. But if Anna is innocent, this is good news. The best she could have hoped for. Martina decides to focus on that. And she has some news for Anna. News she's pretty sure hasn't gotten to Anna's legal team yet. She's been debating whether or not to say anything since the second they got on the phone. But in this moment, it seems right. She has to tell her. Want to hear something potentially exciting? Always, Anna says. This morning, I was working at the shop, and Amelia brought Paisley in around the end of my shift. Okay, Anna says slowly, and it strikes Martina that the mention of Anna's former employers must not be easy. While it's hardly the worst part of all of this, Anna lost her summer job along with everything else. Bear with me, she says. While they were eating their ice cream, Amelia got a call. It sounded like she was talking to her husband. Tom? Right, Tom. So she tells him that they're at Jenkins, and that she took Paisley here as a reward for, get this, speaking with the detectives this morning. About what? Anna's voice pitches up. Did she say? Not specifically, Martina says. But what aside from your case could Paisley Bellamy possibly need to speak to detectives about? Maybe they were giving a character statement. Maybe, Anna muses. I'll ask. If the case does go to trial, maybe my lawyers want Amelia and Paisley to speak as witnesses on my behalf. I'm not really sure how all that works. Me either, Martina admits. But this is a good thing, Anna. It has to be. Things are happening, finally. I just want to go home, Anna says, her voice small. I don't even care anymore if I never find out what really happened. I'm so tired. I know, Martina says, although she doesn't. Not at all. She doesn't have any idea how Anna must feel, locked up in juvie week after week. And while Anna might be too tired to care about the truth, Martina isn't. The need to know burns inside her, intense and center of the sun hot. She's so close to the truth, she can taste it, molten lava scorching her tongue.
Chapter 27. Then, August. Heron Mills, New York. Over the past 3 days, I've reread Zoe's messages so many times, I've lost track. December 10th. Hi, I tried to add you, but it looks like we don't have any mutual friends. I know this is random, but there's something I'd really like to talk to you about. I'm in Providence, at school, but I'm going to be home over winter break soon, and you're in Brooklyn, right? I could come out there, or you could come to Heron Mills. Message me back. December 28th. Hey, Anna. I don't know if you saw my last message. Anyway, I'm home now. If you take the LIRR to Bridgehampton, I'll come pick you up. I'd be happy to pay for your ticket. There's some stuff I think you should know, and I'm not trying to be cryptic. It's just better if we talk in person. I'm at 631-959-4095 if you want to give me a call. When I read her messages one way, she's writing to a girl she knows. When I read them again, she's talking to a stranger. I read them so many times I can recite Zoe's words in my sleep. On Saturday night, I'm alone in the pool house. Zoe's messages open on my screen. I look away, but the words dance along the bedroom wall. She gave me her number. I didn't respond to her on Messenger, but I could have called her. I don't remember doing it, but then again, I don't remember reading these messages before either, and Messenger shows that I did. I click over to my call log, but I already know I won't find anything there. I've only had this phone since June. A persistent voice inside my head says, I called Zoe in December.
that 3 days later, I came to Heron Mills like she asked. And then she disappeared. I stare at her messages one more time. Then I write back. August 1st. Zoe? Hello? In the 2 weeks that have passed since my last awkward movie night with Caden, we've texted some. But I've only seen him a couple times around the neighborhood when I've been out with Paisley, and neither of us has suggested making another plan to hang out. Charlie's come and gone from Windermere a few times over the past week, although as far as I can tell, he's only gotten as far as replanting the grass in the backyard. The ruins of the stable remain untouched. Not that I've been spying. Much. On Sunday, 4 days after I discovered Zoe's messages on my phone, I sit alone in the pool house for what seems like the 100th evening in a row. Dinner's over, and there's still so much night left. I think about texting Martina, but I basically invited myself along last weekend. I should probably wait for her or Aster to invite me next time. Finally, I pull up my last messages with Caden and fire off a text. It's clear that things have shifted between us, but only I know why. If Caden thinks I got weirded out by his mom or lost interest in his friendship or even that I had something to do with the fire, he has kept his thoughts to himself. Over the past 4 days, my mind has been churning, Zoe's messages triggering more and more fragments of memories that don't fit together. There's the indoor pool at Zoe's house, but it's not just that. I've been remembering specific details about Zoe. I've scratched the surface of something. I just need a little more information to connect the dots, and I think Caden can help. Hey, long time. I stare at Caden's reply, then start typing. Yeah, I know, just busy. You want to come over and hang? Can't really leave, as per usual. But you can come over here. Come around front. You can see the work I've done on the pond. A few minutes later, I'm waiting for Caden to let me in at the front gate. It hits me that this might be the last time he invites me over to Windermere. After everything I'm about to ask, he'll probably give me a wide berth. But I can't help it. I need answers. Caden has them. It's only a little after 7, and the sun is still bright in the sky. Caden gives me a tour of the renovated pond, which he says is ready for fish again. The overgrowth has been cleared away, revealing a pretty stone rim around the edge. He explains that the whole thing had to be drained, the liner and skimmer pump replaced, and so on. Honestly, compared to the shape of the estate's interior, fixing up the koi pond seems a bit like putting lipstick on a pig, but with Mrs. Talbot's health and indoor aviary, I can see why he would want to focus his energy on an attainable goal. I plop down in the grass and hug my knees to my chest. Tonight I'm wearing my hair down, and my sunglasses are propped on top of my head. The Zoe factor is in full effect, and somehow that feels fitting. I don't know how to explain this, really, I say, so I'm just going to dive in. I need to ask you a couple questions about Zoe. Caden frowns and joins me in the grass.
You're not recording this for Martina, are you?
He narrows his eyes as if I might be concealing a wire under my clothes. What? No, it's just, over the last few days, I've remembered some things. At least I think they're memories. That's why I need your help.
Things about Zoe?
His voice is filled with skepticism.
Like the pool?
I know it sounds crazy, I say, then stop. Probably using that word around a kid with a mentally ill parent isn't cool. What I mean is, I know it sounds impossible or really strange, but Zoe and I think we knew each other. I take a deep breath and continue.
The first week I was here, Paisley and I went to Jenkins Creamery, and they had this featured flavor, chocolate caramel popcorn. I don't even like caramel usually, but I had to order it. And then it hit me, all these weeks later. That was Zoe's favorite flavor. That's why I remembered it. Caden's mouth is hanging slightly open. I'm right, aren't I? I press. My heart is a wild animal in my chest. This is it. Caden's going to help me solve this thing. He nods, then swallows.
She always ordered it. Never wanted to try anything else.
Her favorite color, I go on. It's gold. She'll go for yellow as a compromise, but she loves gold best.
Gold looks really great with her complexion, Caden says.
She'd always say it made her feel like a princess, I finish for him. Because somehow, I know. I remember. She told me that too. We did meet up in December. Maybe we even knew each other from before. This is not just in my head.
Holy shit, Caden says.
The look on his face isn't surprise. It's something between shock and horror. She loved all kinds of animals, I continue, confidence growing. She was great with them, but she was terrified of thunderstorms, like drenched in sweat, full-on anxiety attack terrified. There was this one closet on the first floor of her house, right between the bathroom and the living room, where she'd go during storms. There was a light in there, and all the coats. They'd muffle the sound.
Astrophobia, Caden says softly. She worried about storms at sea. Didn't want the phobia to hold her back from participating in marine research trips. We talked about it a lot.
I nod. There's no way my brain could have cooked that up. It's so specific. It has to be a memory, which means this last one is too. And her favorite poem, our favorite poem, was Tennyson's The Lady of Shalott. I've loved it since childhood, ever since I saw Anne of Green Gables. Anne tries to act out the poem and almost drowns in the lake. Caden's eyes pop. I know it sounds morbid, I continue, but she gets rescued by her arch nemesis, Gilbert Blythe. I think Zoe and I used to recite the poem together, our favorite stanzas, just like Anne did. The poem is the most beautiful tragedy, and it was ours. For a moment, we're both silent. All the pieces that have been shifting and crossing like shadows in my mind are taking full, vibrant form. These memories are real. Caden's confirmed it. In a way I still can't account for, Zoe was a part of my life. Then Caden asked the question I've known would be coming. How do you know all this, Anna? I'm silent because I don't know what to say. Fact. Zoe messaged me in December, before she disappeared. Fact. I know things about her life that only a friend would know. After that, it all gets blurry.
Is this some sick kind of joke? Caden is saying. Is this coming from Paisley?
No, I say, my voice insistent. I promise it's not that.
Because you look a lot like her, he says. As you know. You sure you're not just a little fixated? No one would blame you for being curious. But this, whatever this is with the pool, and now all these supposed memories about Zoe, it isn't healthy. You need to drop it.
My breath catches because a part of me knows he's right. Everything about this feels very, very not healthy, almost dangerous. But I swear to God, I say, I'm not making this up. For a moment, Caden looks like he wants to scream at me. But when he speaks again, his voice is calm.
Before, you told me you used to party a lot. Blackout. Did that happen often?
More than it should have.
Did it happen on New Year's?
I don't say anything. I can see something happening behind Caden's eyes. There's some kind of calculus at work, variables shifting, a formula taking shape. I shove myself up off the grass. I should go.
Caden gets up too. I think maybe you should.
There's a hard edge to his voice, a meanness there. Look, I'm not lying to you, I say, suddenly defensive. After all, he's the one who's been lying to everyone about his supposedly perfect relationship with Zoe while he was trying to get up the nerve to leave her for Tiana. These memories are real.
If you know something about where she is, Caden says, jaw twitching, you need to tell someone, Anna. You need to tell the police.
I don't. I take a step back. My heart is beating wild again. I swear.
Caden gives me a hard stare. I try to hold his gaze, but it's piercing right through me. I think you should stay away from Windermere for a while, he says.
My eyes fly automatically to the house, to the ravens gathered once more on the third floor balcony rail. A window opens, and for a moment, the sky in front of Windermere is a cloud of black feathers. Then the birds reconvene in a nearby tree, revealing the thin face of Mrs. Talbot at the window, her words from Tom's party, which seems a million years ago now, come flooding back to me.
I won't expect to see you at Windermere again. We don't need anything stirred up.
I turn and run. Chapter 28. Then, August, Heron Mills, New York. My dreams are filled with a crackling, hissing static I can't switch off. Even when I wake, it's like a swarm of angry bees has taken up residence in my head and won't leave. Mercifully, Paisley has a Monday morning playdate with Rachel, so I get a few hours to myself. I float aimlessly in the Bellamy's pool, trying to clear my head, decompress. I need to get it together. I need to snap out of this, whatever this is. I dive under, let the water swirl around my body in a cool embrace. I imagine the bees swarming out of my ears, my nose, my mouth, drowning on the slick navy tile below. When I float back to the surface, they're louder than ever. I can't focus. My skin itches where my sunburn faded weeks ago. The thought of food makes my stomach heave. When Elizabeth drops Paisley off in the early afternoon, I take her to Jenkins and chew ice cubes while she eats. We go to a movie we've already seen twice, and in the dark theater, my mind wanders to rooms filled with murky water and girls in gold dresses tumbling through blackness. When the movie ends, I sit frozen in the theater seat until Paisley shakes my hand. Anna, it's time to go.
I forgot where we were. I forgot about Paisley altogether. I can't trust myself with her. I can barely hold two thoughts in my head at once. Zoe and I were friends. I blacked out on New Year's Eve. Monday's dreams are more static. When I wake on Tuesday, I'm not sure I've slept at all. In the bathroom mirror, dark rings bloom beneath my eyes like heavy storm clouds. I try to cover them up, but the concealer only succeeds in making me look like a ghost who lost a bar fight. The bees prod me into the kitchen, where Amelia has the local news switched on. I fill a bowl with fruit I know I won't eat, while a reporter announces that swimming and fishing have been prohibited in Parrish Lake until further notice.
They found toxic algae, Paisley says through a mouthful of cereal. I want to see.
I nod. Parrish Lake, I can do this.
Okay, I don't know how much we'll be able to see, but we can walk over after breakfast and check it out. The bees hum louder in my ears. Most of Heron Mills seems to have the same idea. Anyone who isn't working is gathered on the shore, watching a crew of park staffers thread across the water on small boats. It's hot out, but I can't stop shivering. Some boaters are pouring something that looks like cat litter from large bags into the lake, while others skim the surface with nets and collect ropes of greenish-brown algae from the bottom with long, sturdy rakes. Paisley spots Martina further down in the crowd and tugs me over to join her. It's a fish-safe chemical herbicide, she says, barely glancing up from her phone to greet us. I already asked. I look at her screen, which is open to the Notes app. The words dance like tiny insects in the sun. I think about ants, frying beneath a magnifying glass, and shiver again. Martina keeps typing, then finally drops her phone to her side. Fascinating stuff? My voice sounds strangely high-pitched and strained through the bee's persistent drone. She shrugs. School starts back up in a few weeks. I need to go into the semester with a few ideas for the paper. I nod vigorously, and her face bobs up and down, up and down. For the first time, Martina looks straight at me. Are you okay? You look a little sallow. I'm fine, I say quickly. Just didn't sleep right. Martina starts to say something else, but before she can get the words out, Paisley is tugging on her dress pocket. Tell me what happened. She cranes her neck to get a better view through the crowd of adults. On TV, they said that fish died. Yeah, Martina says, attention turning to Paisley. There was a big fish kill over the weekend, and they did some testing. Looks like there's some new plant life in one part of the lake, and it's toxic to fish. Might also be harmful to humans and pets. They didn't find any in the swimming area, but to be safe, they're doing full-scale algae control this week before they open the lake back up for use. Wow, Paisley says, impressed. I wrap one arm around my waist. I can't tell if I'm hungry or nauseous. I forced down a few bites at dinner last night, to be polite, but I can't remember the last full meal I ate. It must have been dinner on Sunday, before Caden told me to stay away from Windermere. My stomach heaves, then settles into a tight, painful knot. Martina squats down next to Paisley and points toward a park attendant standing on the shore a few feet in front of us, directing one of the boats out further into the lake. Paula Ames, Heron Mills Parks Director, extremely helpful. I let my eyes travel out across the lake, toward the center of the water, closer to the bank that faces the Arling windmill than the shallow, roped-off swimming area. A woman with one of the long rakes is speaking into a walkie-talkie. She's much too far out for me to hear what she's saying, but in the other boats, I can see people lifting their walkies to their ears, then the boats start motoring toward her. Someone in the first boat to arrive raises what looks like a massive spotlight and shines it down into the water below. Paula Ames's walkie crackles to life on the shore in front of us, and suddenly the bees are silent. Hey, Paula, I think we got something out here. Looks like a small boat sunk to the bottom. It's about 10 yards down, give or take, so we're going to need to bring in a diver. The crowd takes up the buzzing the bees left behind. I hear murmurs of Catherine Hunt's missing motorboat, and do you think she tried to take it out on the lake? And Zoe, and Zoe, and Zoe. My eyes latch on to the water's bright surface,